The rising inequality and growing political instability that we see today are the direct result of decades of bad economic theory.
It's time to build our economy from the bottom up and from the middle out, not the top down.
Middle-out economics is the answer.
Because Wall Street didn't build this country. Great middle class built this country.
The more the middle class thrives, the better the economy is for everyone, even rich people like me.
This is Pitchfork Economics with Nick Hanauer, a podcast about how to build the economy from the middle out. Welcome to the show.
If someone steals money from their employer, they could be guilty of a serious crime. But what if an employer takes money from their employees' paychecks?
In the shadows of corporate greed and exploitation lies a sinister crime that is silently perpetrated, leaving countless victims in its wake. A crime that affects millions of hardworking Americans every year and sucks billions out of our economy. Of course, we're talking about wage theft.
Wage theft costs Americans more than any other type of theft each year.
No industry is immune to this insidious crime, from restaurant workers to construction laborers.
Wage theft means workers not getting money they earn.
Wage theft is rampant.
Today, we're joined by Terry Gerstein, director of the Labor Initiative at NYU Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service, to unpack the chilling truth behind these workplace crimes, learn who the perpetrators are, and uncover how they get away with it.
My name is Terry Gerstein. I'm the director of the NYU Wagner Labor Initiative, and I work to try to help government work more effectively for working people. And how I do that is by focusing on trying to enlist more players in enforcing workers' rights and help those who are already enforcing workers' rights to be more effective and build their capacity.
Well, we're so fired up to talk to you, Terry. I'm not sure if you know, but Pitchfork Economics is this thing that we do at Civic Ventures, but Civic Ventures is principally a policy shop. We find problems and generate policies and build narratives and run campaigns. And the issue of wage theft and the proposition around criminalizing it is something that we're really interested in right now and think it's kind of the next big step in worker rights. So getting to talk to an expert like you about it is very exciting for us and timely. So why don't we start by you just explain the problem that we have in the United States and how bad it is and how far behind we are?
Well, we have a real problem with wage theft and other kinds of workplace exploitation in our country. Some of the commonly cited statistics are that annually there's $50 billion in wage theft. It's very hard to know the exact numbers because a lot of these crimes are unreported for a variety of reasons, including all the obstacles that workers face in bringing cases, like fear of retaliation, for example. But I would note also that wage theft happens not just in a vacuum. Often there's clusters of other kinds of employer crimes. There can be, for example, employers cheating on unemployment taxes and not reporting all their workers so that they pay less. Employers who cheat on workers' compensation in order to get a lower premium. There are prosecutors who are bringing cases involving workplace fatalities that are completely avoidable and not unforeseeable accidents. There have been some prosecutions of child labor cases, and in really extreme cases, labor trafficking prosecutions. So really, there's a whole constellation of conduct, of employer misconduct that prosecutors, a number of prosecutors are increasingly interested in taking on.
The problem is that, you know, we used to enforce these things a lot more rigorously than we do today, right? I mean, I was really struck by the statistic in one of the pieces that you've recently written that, you know, in 1948, there were 1,000 investigators to protect a workforce of 22.6 million. And Now we have 725 investigators for a workforce that's 160 million. I can't exactly do that math in my head, but I think that's like, I mean, you know, like it's basically one tenth as many.
The extent to which we have shrunken our public sector, including enforcement, is really astonishing. And there's a number of trends over the past several decades that really contribute to a degradation of working conditions and the high rate of violations that we see today. There's, you know, the lack of enforcement resources and those numbers that you cited, which I think are really striking. There's also the decrease in union density because our federal labor laws are really outdated. And when you have unions, you have on-site monitors in those workplaces.
Right.
And you have upward pressure in non-union workplaces because they have to compete to get people.
Yeah.
And you also have unions as political actors fighting for stronger standards and fighting for more enforcement resources. So the decline of union density is bad for labor violations as well. So there's a whole number of general trends. The fissuring of the workplace leads to higher workplace violations. That's when employers, businesses, instead of directly employing people, they use subcontractors and staffing agencies. We saw a lot of this in relation to the recent child labor cases that have come to light. But all of these sort of broader trends lead to a situation of much more employer impunity than certainly is appropriate.
Yeah. And it just strikes me in this conversation that we should just back up slightly and just sort of more generally address the issue here. And the issue here, it seems to me, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that, you know, we have criminal laws in our country that most definitely apply to workers, right? So if a worker, for example, steals something from their employer, they will be criminally charged and can go to jail. So if you work in a TV factory and you steal a TV that's worth $1,000, you most certainly, and get caught, you most certainly will be charged and very likely you will be criminally charged and very likely will end up in prison. If your employer, on the other hand, steals $1,000 from 1,000 employees by shortchanging on the hours that you've worked or whatever it is, even if they get caught, their worst downside is to pay the money back with a little bit of a fine. Isn't that true?
Oh, you have hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
And I say exactly that all the time, that if, you know, a lot of times I think there are prosecutors who feel like, well, this doesn't feel criminal in some kind of like vague, inarticulable way. It just doesn't feel criminal. It feels civil. But again, as you said, you know, if a worker embezzled from their employer, no one questions whether that is an appropriate subject for criminal prosecution.
Right.
You know, we routinely have prosecutions, for example, for workers' comp claimant fraud or unemployment claimant fraud, where like there's a person getting benefits that they shouldn't be getting. And of course, that is bad conduct. And I would not like, I'm not a fan of that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when employers cheat on their workers' comp policies or underpay unemployment, cheat on their unemployment taxes, that too is unemployment fraud or workers' comp fraud. And actually, there was a study from the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud last year that was looking specifically at workers' comp fraud and found that employer premium fraud really, really dwarfed claimant fraud in terms of the amount of money involved. So you really,
I'm sure it does.
You know, the impact of employer misconduct on the economy and on communities is really, really considerable. But I do think it's a question of equity to treat these kinds of situations. You know, sometimes also people say, well, you know, prosecutors can't do these cases. They have rapes and murders. But I think most prosecutors do handle property crimes.
Sure.
And they handle nonviolent crimes. And so if you are handling any nonviolent crimes, I think it's a fair question. Why wouldn't these be among that universe of nonviolent crimes that you're routinely prosecuting?
Right. And, you know, for anybody listening, I think it's pretty obvious that if the worst that can happen is that you'll have to pay the wages and maybe get a little bit of a fine, that just becomes the cost of doing business for a lot of people, right?
Absolutely.
They absolutely don't care.
Nick, was it Mitt Romney who made the case that corporations are people?
Yeah.
Right.
When he was running, the problem here, of course, is how do you lock up a corporation?
Yes.
Right. Well, so I have a few answers to that. So first of all, following up on your comment, Nick, about the consequences. Many years ago, there were economists who came up with a theory about employer compliance with labor laws that unethical employers will not comply if the likelihood of detection is too small or if the penalties are too small.
Yeah.
And what you're
By the way,
speaking
you,
about
you don't need an economist to tell you that that's true.
No, of course not. But I actually cite it all the time because okay. I am a lawyer, not an economist. Okay. So I'm always excited when economists like have a bunch of numbers proving something yeah. that I intuitively know to be true from a common sense perspective. Yeah. So that's why I cite Orley, Ashenfelter, and Robert Smith.
There you
who
go.
Came up with that theory. And I do think that, you know, having criminal prosecution involved, it increases the likelihood of detection.
Yes.
Because you have prosecutors all over the country. I think it also increases the perceived likelihood of detection because it gets media coverage.
Yes.
And so it becomes really salient to people in the way that shark attacks or whatever, you know, sort of things
right.
that are dramatic, you know,
yeah.
are salient. And it increases the consequences, not just the monetary consequences, but it creates a whole new set of reputational consequences. And, you know, it's just fundamentally different to be arrested and charged with a crime than to be served with a civil lawsuit or mailed a demand from a labor department.
Yeah.
But in terms of your question, Goldie, about like, what's the situation with prosecuting corporations? I have a couple comments about that. As an initial matter, often the owners themselves are prosecuted as well as the corporate entity. So that's just one initial point. But even when it's a corporation, it can still be very valuable, even though obviously a corporation can't go to jail. The corporation can have significant reputational harm. The corporation can have difficulty in getting government contracts or loans, for example. Also, it can give a criminal prosecution, can give the government leverage to get monitoring or other kinds of changed circumstances, changed ongoing compliance by the corporation. So I think there are still some real benefits, even if it is just the corporation. And one thing I would add as well is like there's a whole conversation about criminal justice reform and how this in growing the footprint of the criminal, you know, most people focused on criminal justice reform want to end mass incarceration and shrink the footprint of the criminal justice system. And so like, how does this vision of prosecuting worker exploitation cases fit into a criminal justice reform vision? And there's a whole separate conversation one could have about that. But one way of sort of threading that needle is prosecuting corporations and getting some of the benefits of the prosecution and the leverage of using the criminal system without bringing potential incarceration into play.
Okay, but for perspective, what do we have, 1 million Americans or 2 million Americans in prison today? Putting a couple hundred CEOs into that system would hardly stress the system, right? Like,
well, Right. I mean, I've thought about this deeply, and I am comfortable with
yeah.
it. You know, I think in a lot of instances, I think it's sort of a question. Realistically, we have a criminal justice system and we have DAs all over the country.
Right.
And how do we want them to be used? What kinds of cases do we want them to be doing?
Yeah.
Do we want them to be prosecuting a mother who stole diapers for her kid or a boss who stole wages from their workers? Right. And there are offices that have started doing this work who have reoriented prosecutors who were previously doing other kinds of prosecutions to now pursue employers. So, you know, I am comfortable with this that this fits well within a progressive prosecutor vision, but I just wanted to surface that in relation to,
yeah.
you know, prosecuting corporations, that's sort of one way of thinking about it.
Is there a criminal profile? Like, is there a is this more typical with large corporations, mom and pop, small businesses, mid-sized businesses?
Yeah, who are the worst offenders?
It's so interesting. That's a really great question. And Nick, your comment about CEOs made me think about this. One of the, you know, it's very challenging. There is this concept of the fissured workplace that I mentioned before, where you have subcontracting. The fissured workplace does make it difficult to go up the chain even civilly. It should be easier. Our definition of employee is suffer or permit to work under federal law and many state laws, but case law has made it much harder to go up the chain and hold people at the top responsible. It's even harder to do that in criminal cases because you have to show intent. And so in most of the criminal cases, I think it's more kind of mid-size, you know, not huge multinationals that have been involved so far. But in terms of the industries, there are, you know, significant violations in the construction industry, restaurants, you know, the service industry generally. When I previously worked in the New York State Attorney General's office for many, many years, and I was the Labor Bureau chief there for a number of years. And we really increased the criminal prosecutions during that time. And we had cases, for example, involving home health agencies where they just completely stiffed home health aides for like a month or two and, you know, continued hiring new people and inducing people to keep working even as they hadn't paid the people who are currently there. So, you know, I think there's a range of industries that are really problematic. And, you know, I do think it's also an issue nationwide in terms of, you know, I don't know if it's possible to say particular regions where there's sort of higher rates of this.
It's weird, though. You mentioned like construction, restaurant service, home health care. These are industries that disproportionately hire minorities and immigrants, and in most of them, women. That's, I can't imagine. That seems strange, right? That's where you would get all of the wage theft.
Now, of course,
people have less power.
Right. Of course. And that's, I mean, obviously, you know, there are so many studies showing that people of color and immigrants and women are often at higher risk of all kinds of workplace violations, from unsafe workplaces to wage theft, discrimination, and everything else.
Yeah. And, you know, we have mostly focused around the simplest kind of thing, which is wage theft, which is basically people not paying you what you earned. But there are a bunch of other issues here having to do with workplace safety, for example, that you've written about, right? Like just super dangerous stuff going on in workplaces that shouldn't be.
OSHA has, similar to the Wage and Hour Division and our wage and hour enforcers, there's just really insufficient resources and really inadequate policy protections for workers in our laws. And some of the workplace safety cases, you know, they involve people who, roofers who are killed falling off of a roof because they're not tied off, yeah. Which, like, you do not need to be an occupational hygienist with 50 years of experience to know if someone's 4 stories or 20 stories off the ground, they need to be tied off.
Yeah.
There are other cases, you know, a couple of cases that really stood out in my mind. There was a case last year involving the Massachusetts AG's office where they indicted an asbestos company that was charged with violating the Clean Air Act based on all of this horrendous, inappropriate, like illegal asbestos abatement, as well as endangering workers. And there was a worker who actually fell several stories through a roof after repeatedly being denied protective safety equipment. And so this is where you see these kind of, I've come to see, you know, mistreatment of workers in some instances is kind of a little bit of a red flag or a canary in a coal mine for like all other kinds of violations.
Yeah.
Like, you know, often there are some cases that New York and Massachusetts attorney generals have brought in which there's Medicaid fraud and also wage theft, right?
Right.
Because
no, bad actors
so
are bad
instances.
Actors.
Totally. Yes.
Scumbags are scumbags.
But again, with the workplace safety issues, another one that case that came out, and I think talking about cases is like, sometimes it feels like kind of war story-ish, but I think it helps make these issues like very concrete for people to be able to understand, like, what does this act like, you know, to the extent people feel uncomfortable with the idea of this being criminalized, like, what does this actually look like? The Manhattan DA recently indicted a construction safety company and its owners who for years had been selling fake workplace safety training certifications in New York City. And they estimated that over about 3.5 years, 20,000 workers, they falsely certified that 20,000 workers had completed 40 hours of safety and health training. And so I think this is a great example of a strategic prosecution because they're going.
I bet the margins in that business were pretty good.
I bet you they didn't pay those workers for those 40 hours.
Well, they didn't do the training, so, you know, they just
wow.
gave their companies. I mean, the workers, you know, and it, to me, it's an example of a really smart strategic
yeah.
prosecution because they're not going after the workers for having the fake OSHA cards. They're going after the companies that are telling people, you know, here, we'll give you the card and then you can work. And that's really the source of where the danger is yeah. sort of originating.
So, Terry, can we move to more practical matters? So do we need to change law to make this better, or do we merely need to enforce more actively?
So my answer to that is why not both,
yeah.
right? But I would say, I mean, I think in most instances, if prosecutors, even in the most worker hostile state, if prosecutors comb through the statutes that they have, in most instances, they will be able to find laws that they can already use. You know, there are theft of services laws, larceny, robbery, there are false documents laws, you know, filing a false document or maintaining false business records that can be used. There are, you know, different kinds of witness intimidation statutes. So I think that if prosecutors look in Minnesota for years, a couple of years ago, they passed a wage theft criminal statute that creates felony status for wage theft above a certain level. But before that, prosecutors were using a statute that sounds like kind of old timey to me, which is theft by swindle. And so, you know, they were swindling
that.
People, isn't
I
that,
love that
right?
That's...
But like, I think most prosecutors, if they look through the statutes, you
okay.
know, sometimes they'll find it. But also, it's good to have stronger statutes. Like sometimes these violations might be misdemeanors, and
you want
prosecutors
them to be felony.
Generally, right? I mean, I think misdemeanors are still impactful. I think if an employer is arrested for wage theft, and that's the headline, that's what other employers are going to look at. They're not going to say, well, that was just a misdemeanor, so I don't really care if I get arrested,
yeah.
right? I think you still get deterrence, but felonies obviously convey a greater seriousness and give more leverage in terms of your ultimate outcome.
Yeah, and I mean, how much do you have to steal as a individual for it to be a felony?
Yeah, I don't know that off the top of my head, but I do know that there's a handful of states that have created felony status for wage theft. And in most cases, it's sort of in the $1,000 to $2,000
yeah.
range. And they were doing that to create parity with other kinds of
yeah.
theft.
Like if you steal a TV for $2,000 and it's a felony, then if you steal wages for $2,000, it should be a felony.
I hope the three strikes and you're out laws apply as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. here's another practical question is, who do you go after in the corporation?
It just depends on the facts. You know, it depends on what facts you have and who knew what. I mean, one question that comes up a lot is a lot of these cases could be brought either civilly or criminally. And like, how do you figure out what's a criminal case versus civil? And the answer is, you know, if it's you have a different standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt instead of preponderance of the evidence, you also have to show intent. When I was in the New York AG's office and I was the labor bureau chief and we had both kinds of jurisdiction, we had a number of factors, but if I had to sum it up in like one sentence, it would be, was there any question that this was inadvertent versus totally knowing and intentional,
yeah.
right? And so the question of who you charge, sort of some of those same issues come up in terms of if it's someone who's many layers up and like really you can't demonstrate that they had much of a connection to this actual conduct. I think that makes it a little bit harder. But again, it depends on the exact statute that you're working with. And it depends on the facts you have.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, on the one hand, the buck truly does stop at the top, right? Like if somebody is practicing wage theft in an enterprise that you manage, they're not doing it by accident.
That's why I would like you to write these laws.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I'm curious, you write about how a lot of these prosecutions are being done at the state and local level by state attorneys, generals, and prosecutors. These are elected officials, largely, that their offices. Is this prosecution bipartisan across the states? Are Republicans and Democrats alike prosecuting wage theft?
Well, I try to follow it as much as I can. You know, I don't know of every single prosecution that has happened anywhere in relation to worker exploitation, but I really do try to follow it. There's a big cluster of prosecutors engaged in this in New York and California, as you might expect. And then there are some in, you know, other places like the Twin Cities in Minnesota have quite a few. I think that generally it is prosecutors who kind of self-identify or are identified as progressive prosecutors or kind of criminal justice reformers who are most interested in this and in thinking about how to use their powers in new and differently oriented ways. But there are some who are just, there are some who are more kind of, you know, traditional prosecutors who are focused on this. For example, in San Diego, the San Diego DA had been a Republican, is now independent, and is one of the offices that has created a worker protection unit and is really, really engaged in this area. So, you know, I don't, my sense is that there aren't really prosecutors on the right who are working on this. And to be honest, I would be concerned about the fate of immigrant workers if they were to get engaged in this area, mm-hmm. frankly. But so there aren't really on the right, but I think it's sort of like a continuum from the left to the center, who are, you know, whatever left means in a criminal justice context, but, you know, from more progressive to the center who are engaged in this.
I don't know. The right claims to be so tough on crime. I guess you're telling me it depends on the crime.
It depends on the crime.
And the criminal.
And it depends on, exactly. No, I mean, I have said, like, we have defunded, you know, everybody talks about, you know, there's the whole conversation about defunding the police, but we have defunded all of the, you know, those who police workplaces to try to keep workers safe and paid and fairly treated. You know, the idea that we have 730, at the end of last year, we had 733 minimum wage, overtime, child labor investigators for the whole country. That is a significant defunding for sure.
In the same way that we've defunded the IRS and their ability
exactly.
to go after, yeah, a big
totally.
Tax sheets. I'm sure that it's just totally coincidental. There's nothing in common
right.
between these two.
Of course.
Is it your view that the action on these issues should be in the states or federally?
Again, my answer is why not both? I mean, I focus in my work primarily on state and local action for a variety of reasons. I think there's a lot of people who are, you know, in the advocacy, policy, you know, all of these worlds who focus on the federal government.
Yeah.
And on federal labor enforcement, and there's really much less support and much fewer resources and sort of, you know, just different methods of playing a role in relation to state and local. And I just see potential everywhere at the state and local level. Like, I think that they have the possibility, you know, at times when the federal government is friendly, states and localities can really be the cutting edge in terms of protecting workers. And when the federal government is not friendly to workers, state and local are kind of all that we have as, you know, our remaining safeguard against, you know, all kinds of employer impunity and violations. So I think this should happen at both levels, but because of all of the untapped potential and sort of so much that can be done at the state and local level, that's why I've been generally focusing on that.
Okay,
area.
And is there a playbook for best practices?
Not yet. There's, you know, I've written a report about this. There are several webinars that I've helped organize and have been part of. I put together a working group. You know, if I were a little more polished, I would call it a community of practice or community of learning. But I put together a cohort of prosecutors from around the country. We have maybe 25 or 30 local, you know, DAs and prosecutors' offices, and then another dozen or so AGs. And we have monthly virtual meetings that I convene and that I facilitate and put together the agenda, and people present case studies. So that's not really the same as a playbook, but it's a lot of sort of building that community helps people learn from each other. But I think we do need more materials in terms of a playbook for how to do this. But I think the EPI report gives people a very good, that I wrote it several years ago, really gives people a very good idea of how to get started.
Interesting. Just parenthetically, is there somebody from Washington State who participates in your group?
Yes, there is. We have
okay,
someone
good.
From the Washington
okay.
AG's office and
okay.
the King County DA's office. So
great.
You guys
excellent.
Are covered.
Excellent. Okay. Excellent.
One other thing that I think has a lot of potential in terms of criminal prosecution is that where you have prosecutors are independently elected, as you noted. And so where you have prosecutors who are in progressive cities in conservative states, there's a real opportunity for action and impact. So if you think about it, like, there's their state doesn't have worker protection laws barely at all. They don't have a state labor department that's super active. The AG doesn't do anything about workers' rights. The state maybe has passed laws preempting cities or localities from taking action. But if you have an elected DA who's bringing wage theft cases under, you know, a robbery or, you know, or bringing worker exploitation cases, that's a way to have some, you know, really impactful government intervention on behalf of workers, highly visible, really impactful, a lot of deterrence, even in a hostile territory. So I think that that's something that's like a worker hostile territory is what I mean. But I, so I think that's something that like has real potential in those states that have preemption.
You don't happen to know if wage theft is a felony in Washington state, do you?
I don't know offhand. I would have to look it up. But I
definitely,
know
I definitely know someone who will know. So don't worry.
and if it isn't, Nick, I want to make it a felony swindle.
Yeah, I love that. I love
that.
Because I want to see people convicted
of felony swindles.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, just a couple of final questions. This has been a fantastic conversation. First, we always ask a malevolent dictator question, which is, if you were in charge and could just do anything, what would you do?
So if I'm a benevolent dictator, one thing I would do is I would pass the PRO Act, which would make it easier for workers to form and join unions because of those reasons I talked about at the outset, that there's fewer violations if you have higher union density. It's easier for workers to complain about violations if they have a union and all of the other, you know, benefits that unions bring to labor equity and enforcement resources and policies. I would expand the Supreme Court. I mean, I guess if I'm a benevolent dictator, maybe I am the Supreme Court.
Okay.
so I would not expand me, but assuming that there is a Supreme Court, I would expand the Supreme Court. I guess also if my benevolent dictator powers are like not entirely all-encompassing and I just have to sort of stick more narrowly to the subject of our conversation today, I would want corporate and employer legal violations of all kinds to just be taken seriously through more public resources, stronger laws, and more enforcement, so we would have greater compliance and fairness in the workplace. And that would include, yes, DAs taking this on and prosecutors, but also more resources for civil enforcement, stronger laws, getting rid of forced arbitration, and just creating more ways to ensure that employers don't have impunity in the workplace.
That's great. And one final question. Why do you do this work?
Well, I've had a commitment to social justice and workers' rights that goes way back. But in terms of why it is manifesting right now in this particular form, I think relates to what I said earlier, that I see so much untapped potential in government and especially in state and local government to have a huge impact on workers' lives and on addressing the power disparity between employers and workers. And that power disparity, it has such an impact on people's lives. People struggle to afford their lives. They can't spend time with their kids because they have such long hours or they're having two jobs. People are under so much stress. And so government has real power. And finding ways to sort of plant allies within government, you know, not plant allies, but trying to find ways to, you know, get government to really leverage its power on behalf of working people, I think is something that can make a really big difference in people's lives.
Terry, thank you so much for being with us today. It was really fascinating. And thanks for your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show. I'm a big fan of the podcast, and this has just been a really fun conversation.
Nick, I'm just shocked that there's gambling going on in our casino.
Yeah.
or wage theft going on in our neoliberal economy. How about you?
Yeah, no, I'm not shocked. And, you know, the thing is, Goldie, is that, you know, this is a podcast focused on economics. And this seemed like an episode devoted to law or justice or fairness. But I just want to remind viewers that, you know, our view of economic cause and effect is very, very clear. When workers are paid more money, businesses have more customers and hire more workers. A thriving middle class causes both economic growth and a stable and secure democracy. And you cannot have those things if you have rampant wage theft. the number people kick around is something like $50 billion. It's five times as much as property crime. So, you know, an extra $50 billion in workers' pockets would make an enormous difference, both to those workers, but equally to the broader economy, which is the point of economic policymaking. And I just think it's crucial that we find ways to create dramatic disincentives for businesses to mistreat workers. I mean, of course, it is possible to make a mistake. Clerical errors are possible. Mm-hmm. We don't want to prosecute people for inadvertent mistakes. But it is really clear that there are a ton of businesses out there that actively seek to steal money from workers, and they should go to jail, just like the person who steals your TV. You know, it should be no difference.
One of the reasons, Nick, that we have to bring the law into this, and this is something that Terry brought up near the end, is the immense power disparity between workers and their employers. This is economics, or at least it should be. It goes all the way back to Adam Smith. He recognized this in The Wealth of Nations. Unfortunately, modern neoclassical orthodox economics just assumes power out of the equation.
Yeah.
That somehow the market will address this, that power does not play a role, that workers are always paid exactly what they're worth, their marginal utility. And so if you have one company cheating workers out of wages, well, the employees will just go to the other companies.
Yeah. But this is
not
true,
of course. And this will all sort itself out in the end, and you don't need to get the law involved. And of course, we all know that is, I don't know, what's the technical word for it in economics?
Bullshit.
Bullshit. That's the word, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, anyway, what an interesting conversation, and what a consequential thing to devote your working life to. So good
absolutely.
For Terry.
And if you want to read more from Terry, we will, of course, provide links in the show notes.
Pitchfork Economics is produced by Civic Ventures. If you like the show, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Civic Action and Nick Hanauer. Follow our writing on Medium at Civic Skunkworks, and peek behind the podcast scenes on Instagram at Pitchfork Economics. As always, from our team at Civic Ventures, thanks for listening. See you next week.